45 or something. Or it's not.
Okay.
Urgent. We're just hearing it. We're not.
Well, I want to come open the House Committee on Land Use. Today is March the 7th at roughly 3 p.m. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3067 and ask Senator Johnson to please come and tell us about this bill.
By the chair's leave, may I be joined by the rest of Area 93, Team Area 93.
Area 51, come on.
Sorry.
This is a first. Wow. I've never seen six at a...
We gather before you in a tangible display of glasnost and perestroika, and momentarily Mr. Tucker will lead us in a few choruses of Kumbaya.
Only
upon
demand.
Get everybody silence. We don't know what to do with that.
I was just going to object.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson, and with redistricting, I am now the state senator representing Area 93. We come before you today with a solution to a vexing problem that has gone on for some time. We arranged ourselves in this tangible display of unity as we advance this bill. You will momentarily hear from Washington County, Multnomah County, Metro, Oregonians in Action, and a representative of the affected families that own property in what is Area 93. I will leave it to your staff to do the summary and describe the problem that we are here to fix, but as a result of some diligent work on behalf of the parties arrayed in front of you, and I must say, building on the leadership supplied by Representative Greenlick and Senator Steiner Hayward, we bring to you a bill that solves a long-standing problem and would respectfully ask that you give it favorable consideration and move it through the process.
We might get our third bill total out of this committee, it looks like. Please.
I can go ahead and go next unless you want to provide a summary. So Jim McCauley, Government Affairs with Washington County. As Senator Johnson said, this is a partnership amongst several different parties. House Bill 3067 provides essentially a template for how a boundary line adjustment will occur between Multnomah and Washington County. Area 93, also known as Bonnie Slope, also known as Whiskey Gulch, about 160 acres or so will be transferred into Washington County. We'll be able to go through planning steps and essentially be able to provide the type of services that this group of landowners expects and move closer to development over the next couple of years as we complete this planning cycle. So with those comments, it's been a process that has gone on, 6 months to a year, several meetings between Washington County and Multnomah County staff, as well as Metro and the City of Portland on this. We are continuing to meet because this is not a flick of the switch for anybody who has been through a boundary change in the past. There's a lot of stuff that has to be transferred, and there's a lot of statutory guidance that has to be followed in this process. And again, the way the bill is written, it's structured to allow the counties to come to that agreement, and we've got until January 1 of 2014 to complete this process. And the good news is we've been doing a lot of work on this already. So with that, I'll let the rest of my colleagues go forward.
So before you go any further, one thing I might, just for those of you who weren't here last session or paying attention to this kind of stuff, the basic issue, Representative Sheehan and Juan brought a bill, brought it to sort of our attention in a different committee that was handling land use at the time. The basic issue was these stranded parcels in Multnomah County that due to other, I think it was some sort of rural reserves, were essentially never going to be able to be served by Multnomah County because of where they were physically located. So this is the solution to that, how to get these properties served by a different unit of government. It's kind of a big instrument moving a county line in statute, I know, but that apparently will solve this long-standing issue of this one stranded area that just due to geography and other policy decisions, couldn't figure out a way to get it done. I think that's right, basically. Thanks.
That's a very good explanation of why we're here.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Claudia Black. I'm co-director of government relations for Multnomah County, and I'm here today to support House Bill 3067. As you've heard, this has been a collaborative effort over the past year, And there's not much I can add to what Senator Johnson and Mr. McCauley had to say, except that we feel that this is a very good solution, and it's a product of a lot of hard work and collaboration. We'd like to thank the leadership in the legislature, Senator Johnson and Senator Steiner Hayward, Representative Greenlick, and the Washington County Commission and Metro for their leadership. And we urge the passage, Multnomah County urges the passage of 3067. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Metro's Legislative Affairs Manager. Thank you, Claudia. I don't want to get into much detail either. I think you explained it fairly well, Mr. Chair. I think I would just add to your explanation, for those that aren't familiar with it, that this is a piece of land that's nestled up against Washington County and completely separated, as you pointed out, by rural reserves from any other urbanized area of Multnomah County. So that's the problem. This is a situation that is unique and not likely to be repeated. Metro has, since this happened, Metro has changed some of the rules around urban growth boundary expansions. We won't be able to have something like this happen in the future. I think we've made sure that that won't happen. I also want to say that in addition to the many meetings that we've had between Metro and Multnomah and Washington counties to try to hash out what a good solution would be, and we threw a lot of solutions against the wall and kept coming back to this one. There have also been, probably over the years, untold numbers of meetings of the landowners. I had the privilege of attending one of those meetings a few months ago, and I just wanted to comment on the record for you, as I've said elsewhere, that I was very impressed. Given how long this land has been in some sort of planning limbo, I was very impressed with the sort of spirit of solution orientation and the positive attitude of the landowners. And so I just wanted to make sure that that was stated to you as well. So with that, I'll just say that Metro strongly supports House Bill 3067. That's the number, right? And urge your I vote.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of 3067. It needs to be made clear that this property is inside the urban growth boundary. It was brought inside the urban growth boundary in 2002 by Metro, but because of difficulties in providing the basic services, sewer and water, transportation, neither Multnomah County nor the City of Portland could serve the property. We came down last session, Mr. Nelson and I, along with a couple other folks, and had House Bill 4090, which
got hijacked
which Chair Clem is familiar with. It turned into a Frankenstein's monster bill of three or four different great ideas.
We're going to get them all done this session too. Yeah, right here in this committee.
The heft of the whole was a little too much for the building. So this session we are separating them out apparently into different pieces. But this was the one part of 4090 that really there was no objection to. It's a problem that needs to be fixed. This area needs to be served. Sewer and water stub right to the county line and basically right to Area 93. So if we can move the boundary over, move this property out of Multnomah County and into Washington County, then Washington County will provide the services, master plan the property, and the property will develop as it's required to under our land use laws because it is inside the urban growth boundary. So this is the part of 4090 that there was no objection to. It makes good sense, and we really we're all very supportive of the bill itself. So, thank you.
My name is Mike Nelson. I'm actually here as a property owner, also representing the other property owners in the area. And last fall, Representative Greenlick and Washington County Chair Andy Dyke asked me to organize a meeting of the property owners to see whether there was any sort of local interest in moving out of Multnomah County and into Washington County as his suggestion for a solution to our problem. So we had this meeting and we had a very good turnout. We had overwhelming support from the people that were at the meeting, but Representative Greenlick suggested that we actually prepare a petition and to demonstrate the actual support from the property owners. So that map that you have in front of you The shaded areas are actually representative of those landowners in Area 93 that have actually signed the petition that said they're supportive of moving out of Multnomah County into Washington County. So it represents, you know, 42 of the 55 landowners. It's 88% of the acreage, or 140 of the 160 acres represented in there. So this is an unbelievable, you know, solution to a problem that the property owners have been dealing with for over a decade. And, you know, we are very supportive of it. Those of us who are most affected by this bill, I think there's overwhelming support for it, and we appreciate your considering it and pushing it on. Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chair,
thank you.
By way of sort of the last word on this, I'd like to make two other comments. On behalf of the homeowners, I think that there has been an interest in knowing that everyone at this table will move expeditiously to get this planning work done by the date prescribed in the bill. And I can assure you, having been personally in the meetings, that there is that interest in moving this quickly. The homeowners have waited a long time. And last, I think you've heard it from several of us, I again want to thank Representative Greenlick for his leadership in bringing us to this point. I know that some of you have gone through redistricting. You have lost parts of your district in which you were very heavily invested, and parting is sort of sweet sorrow. And I ended up coming into this bill and this issue after Representative Greenlick's service in the area had ended and his district boundaries changed. But we would not be before you with this solution absent his leadership at the beginning of the odyssey. I think the fact that you have such disparate groups all standing here in agreement is testimony to the hard work that has occurred here, and I just want to acknowledge Representative Greenlick's significant commitment to get us to this point today. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. I will note for the record that somebody stole about 15 houses from me during redistricting. I'm smarting over it still.
I lost a lot more acreage.
Yeah, I know you did.
A lot more than that for somebody.
Any questions for this kumbaya moment? Please, Representative Holvey, ruin it if you can. But
you know. No. I applaud the effort. There's no doubt. There's a fairly extensive legal description in the bill, obviously. And I'm just curious, you know, the history of that legal description and whether or not this is going to generate a physical survey to establish the boundary.
I can
to make answer. Sure that it's the legal description actually matches the real world.
Yes, Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, the survey language in there obviously is extensive enough to make your eyes bleed. It was done by surveyors from both Washington and Multnomah County. So they are in total agreement with the physical legal description and how you have to move yourself around this amoeba, because it obviously isn't a straight quarter section type of description.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, follow up.
So that was done relatively recently. So it was what I'm gathering, that we're not relying on something that's 50 years old.
No, Chair Clay, Representative Holvey, it was completed last month.
Thank you. Makes me feel a little better.
Yeah,
you do.
So, Senator Johnson, whose house is this, Representative Witt or Bones? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's Witt.
Okay, thank you. Okay, anything else? Okay, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
And I have no further sign-ups on this
thank
bill.
You.
Yeah, so with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3067 and open a work session on House Bill 3067.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3067 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Representative Cameron moves House Bill 3067 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative
Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative
Unger? Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Chair Clinton?
Aye. Bill passes to the floor. We'll see if Representative Witt wants to carry it. If not, then I will carry it. Okay, let's thank you, everybody. You can
thank you.
Don't have to stick around, but if you want to, I'm sure some of our other partners here want you to hear all about Land Use 101 from the many hours of interim work done by the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I'm stalling because I don't see Richard Whitman. Oh, yes, never mind. Let me open public hearings on House Bills 2253, 2254, and 2255. And colleagues, you recall in the first hearing, I always want to call him Director Whitman, but that's not his title anymore. Richard Whitman from the governor's office talked about these package of bills. They've probably been in your office to visit you, so we're finally ready to hear in real-world terms about the bills, the package of bills. It's already minus one, I notice, from the department.
Hit the space bar.
One.
That's not the right.
And it has this.
Oh, it's all right. This would be good. Technically, I was waiting when I was going to get this overview.
I really don't want to do healthcare.
If you can wrap this into land use, this is going to be awesome presentation.
Any questions about slide 3?
No, not that one. The other one.
No. That's
one of them.
The one next to the right. Try the one to the right. There you go.
Oh, that's the healthcare one.
That's the healthcare. Where did it go?
You I mean, 2253 is the right one, right?
I could recess, yeah, but she's not there, so.
Yes.
We'll let the committee stand in recess for a moment.
Sorry.
It's okay. I was... don't need to tape all my private conversations, so what's going on?
Still on.
See? Wait for it.
Oh, hey.
Okay.
Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Klim, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resource Advisor, and I have to my left Jim Rue, who is the Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And we have a number of people who are going to be presenting to you today, including Carrie McLaren, who's the new Deputy Director at the Department, as well as Aaron Doyle from the League of Cities. I want to start out by just thanking a couple people for the hard work on this. What you're going to see today is the result of over a year of work by a team of folks who have been working on modernizing the urban part of Oregon's land use system. But particularly, I want to thank some folks from the League of Cities, Linda Ludwig, and also Aaron Doyle, who's going to be doing part of the presentation later. The bills that you have before you today, House Bill 2253, House Bill 2254, and 55, are not in the form that we want the committee to act on yet. There are amendments pending with Legislative Council on the bills, so we will be back once we have those amendments from Legislative Council to go through the final form of the bills. But we are going to present the concepts behind the bills today to you, and a number of folks who have worked on this effort over the last year are going to testify to the concepts. Okay, so first slide, Jim, please. I want to start out by talking about some of the successes of the Oregon Land Use Program on the urban side. Some of you may have a distant memory of the beginning of the legislative session when we did a Land Use 101. And I'm going to repeat just a couple of things that we talked about in that session, but that I want to emphasize for purposes of these bills. The first is data regarding how much residential development has occurred outside of cities in Oregon as opposed to our neighboring states. You'll see up on the slide data comparing Oregon with Washington and Idaho over the last 10 years of census data. Virtually no growth in housing units in Oregon outside of urban areas, whereas in Washington and Idaho we've seen fairly significant growth in the number of housing units. Next slide. That also translates within urban growth boundaries. We have had almost as much growth in terms of population as our neighbor to the north, Washington, but we've done it on about 75% of the land area that they have done proportionally. So we are making more efficient use of our urban areas than our neighboring states, either Washington, Idaho, or California, largely, I believe, as a result of our land use program. Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? Well, we could debate that, but in terms of fiscal costs to local government, it's more efficient to have that population accommodated on a smaller land area. It also means we have done a better job in terms of conserving our important farm and forest lands for those industries. Next slide. So, key fact, over the life of the land use program, 98% of the land that was in farm or forest use in 1974 remains in those uses as of 2009. Next. So, I want to talk about the urban side a little bit also. So we had, in the last couple of years, 11 urban growth boundary amendments that added almost 3,000 acres to urban growth boundaries. A large proportion of that land was farmland. Over the longer period, from 1988 to 2011, we've had almost 52,000 acres added to urban growth boundaries. That translates into the total number of acres in Multnomah County, for instance, is almost 300,000 acres of land. Here in Marion County, it's a little bit over 750,000 acres of land. So it's a relatively small amount of land that has been used to accommodate substantial population growth in the state. During the beginning of that period, you'll note that a lot of the land that was used to add to urban growth boundaries was not farmland or forest land. Actually, a lot of rural residential land was used initially to add to urban growth boundaries. Next slide. And you're not going to be able to read this, but this just gives the details on the number of urban growth boundary amendments by year and the acres of land added to urban growth boundaries, and then some detail on how much is from agricultural land, how much is from forest land. Next slide. So what's the problem? Well, we do have some problems. We have some significant problems with the land use system. The program has gotten more and more complex over the years. The cost of managing our urban growth system has gone up. The amount of time it takes to go through an urban growth boundary amendment has extended to a point where by the time we're done with the urban growth boundary amendment, it's basically time to start over again. There's been an enormous amount of litigation. And last, but and most important, is a lack of transparency. Our citizens have enormous difficulty understanding our land use program. It has gotten so complex that the average person can't effectively participate in land use decision making at the local level, and that's a real problem long term in terms of the stability of our system. Next slide. So just to point out on the litigation side, this is a listing of the litigation we've had over urban growth boundary amendments in the last several years. And it's a mix. There have been a few urban growth boundary amendments that have been upheld, but a number have been sent back. So we're now at a point in our system where I believe, this is personal opinion, that many local governments are afraid of taking on an urban growth boundary amendment because the cost is so great, the uncertainty of the outcome is so high, they simply don't want to undertake it. And so our system is at a point where it is so boxed up that the pressure in the system is growing and growing. And that is really what the legislation that's before you today is aimed at. It's aimed at simplifying the system, making the choices clear to our citizens, and if local governments make decisions that are reasonable decisions within parameters that mean we're still protecting our farmland and our forest land, they shouldn't be getting wrapped around the axle and having to go through years and years of litigation. Okay. So we're going to have presentations on each of these bills, House Bill 2253. Jim and Carrie McLaren and Aaron Doyle from the League of Cities are going to do, and then I'm going to come back and talk to you about 2254 and 2255.
Chair Clem. Question?
Yep. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Can you talk about who was at the table in drafting this legislation? And I really appreciate your presentation. I think it summed it up very nicely.
Thank you. Chair Clem, Representative Davis, absolutely. So there was a small team of people who worked on a frequent basis in terms of the details of this, but then a larger group as well. So it included representatives from counties, representatives from the development community, the home builders, League of Cities, planners, attorney representatives of local government, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Oregon Department of Transportation, Metro, Thousand Friends,
Farm Bureau.
Consultants, Farm Bureau. I'm looking at my list. I think that's just about everybody. So it's a pretty broad group of interests that have worked on this. And if I may, your question prompted me to mention one other thing, which is actually very important. This legislation applies outside of Metro. Metro is carved out from this legislation, and the reason for that is you just heard some of the fallout from the last planning process in Metro, but the legislature put in place a new planning system for Metro about 6 years ago in terms of urban and rural reserves, which I'm sure you've probably heard of. That system has worked its way through. We have some appeals pending, but those decisions have been made. And there was a strong desire on the part of Metro to let that play out, let that new system play out before we apply any of the ideas that we've worked on in this group to the Metro area. It may be eventually that this is appropriate to apply to Metro, but the desire for now is to work this in other parts of the state. Thank you. Okay. All right.
All right.
Okay, Chair Clem, members, for the record, Jim Rue, Director, Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm going to spend, I hope, the very briefest bit of time doing an overview of 2253, which is the population forecasting bill. As you know, population forecasts form the foundation for all planning that follows. Oregon has a statute currently which requires that counties coordinate the population forecast among the cities within the county. Today, there are probably fewer than 15 counties out of our 36 that are in compliance. And there are a whole range of reasons why that is probably true. So what we are proposing as a remedy is that Population Research Center at Portland State supply a county by county forecast every single year, and then on a 4-year cycle do roughly a fourth of the cities, the counties and their constituent cities, on a cycle that will simply repeat itself. So taking roughly a fourth of the population of the state each year and then cycling through. We will pay for it. We have a POP to cover part of the costs of that population forecast. It will save cities and counties by various estimates scores of thousands to perhaps hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. They will no longer have to go to consultants and get into battles of consultants. There will be an opportunity for individual communities to have input and, in fact, an actual challenge to the initial forecast coming out of PSU. And perhaps the most important feature of all, that when a city adopts this population forecast, the forecast itself is deemed not to be a land use action and therefore not appealable to LUBA. So I'm going to stop right there because Aaron and Jason are way closer to this and have been working on this to devise the program. But if you have any questions, obviously I'll be here when they're done. Thank you.
Go ahead.
How do we change the PowerPoint presentation?
Yeah, that's
originally, Jason was going to go after they all went, and so he has a completely separate PowerPoint of his own, so theirs is still loaded because it has the overview. So I've explained it to her, but we'll see how this works.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to chat with you today about the population forecasting program. For the record, my name is Jason Jurgovich. I'm acting director of the Population Research Center at Portland State and also assistant professor of urban studies and planning. So a little bit about the Population Research Center. There's been some questions around why Portland State. We house the Population Research Center, which serves four functions for Oregon. We have the Population Estimates Program, which is the annual Population Estimates Program for the state, where we provide population estimates for all cities and counties on an annual basis. We also serve as the Oregon State Data Center, which most of you have probably have some familiarity when we've been down to Salem to talk about the public law file around redistricting. We get that from the Census Bureau and make sure that that file is available to you with related to redistricting in Oregon. We do a number of consulting projects, including population forecasting. We've done a number of coordinated county population forecasts for counties across the state. We also do other consulting type work that is focused around demographics. And we also teach courses in applied demography, particularly with respect to training our planning students at Portland State. In its entirety, our center has over 50 years of training and experience with respect to demographic forecasting methods, forecasting, census data, and statistical analysis. So on our website, there are two areas of the website that are probably applicable or I would direct you to is the annual population estimates for Oregon, which is the circled bar at the top. The latest estimates that we have provided are July 1, 2012 figures for every city and every county in the state. And then that link to the right is the Oregon Census State Data Center. So any census data that you're interested in for your district, for a particular census tract, for changes in demographic trends, that's available at that link. So a little bit of clarity around an estimate versus a forecast, because there's been some questions around what do we have that's already in place and how does the forecasting population forecasting differ? Population estimates refer to a historical point in the past. So again, the usual date that we use is July 1. The estimates program was put into place in the 1950s in Oregon under that ORS statute there. And so we provided the latest estimates for Oregon and its counties and cities as of July 1 at the end of the 2012 fiscal year. And the estimates are important for a number of things, including distribution of state revenues to cities and counties. The population forecast is an estimation of future population based on historical and current trends and assumptions about likely future events. So typically these are arranged in terms of short-term forecasts and long-term forecasts. For the purposes of this program, we're talking about long-term population forecasts. We're talking about 50-year forecasts. So the importance of forecasts, they're essential. Under Oregon law, counties are required to have updated, coordinated population forecasts as a part of coordinated land use. They serve as the basis for growth management, for UGB expansions, as well as planning-related issues for distributing revenue and resources around transportation planning, school facility plans, and capital improvement projects. So having accurate and updated and timely information about what population looks like into the future is essential for that, for those planning purposes. So why do we need a coordinated county population forecast program? One of the issues is costs. Many counties are not operating with updated coordinated county forecasts. And for many counties, having an updated coordinated county forecast is quite expensive, and they just simply don't have the resources to be able to hire an outside consultant to be able to get an updated forecast to use for their coordinated plans. As well as the fact, as Jim had mentioned, that some of these forecasts are outdated. They are over 10 years old, up to 15 years of age, and do not represent current trends that are likely to occur into the future. And the third reason for the need for this program is the fact that many different counties pursue different methodologies for doing a coordinated county forecast. And I can address more questions around that if there are questions about the methodologies. But this would provide a uniform methodology for all counties in Oregon. So the benefits, as I'm alluded to this on a couple of the previous slides, as Jim mentioned, we're going to have updated county forecasts on an annual basis under this program, and we will have a quarter of the state will have an updated city-county coordinated forecast every 4 years. The consistency is that the methodology will be even across the state for all the counties that we will be doing the coordinated forecast for. The reduction of the challenges and lawsuits are definitely an upside to this approach, as well as we have improved efficiency. We are the state data center. We have data that we already collect for the estimates program. So one of the advantages of this program is that we would be leveraging some of that data in this program and maximizing some efficiencies around doing this work. So the proposed forecast approach is on an annual basis, month one through month nine. I'm not going to go into each of these months in terms of the specific tasks, but I will point out month two, we will be holding a meeting in a workforce area to collect data from city planners, county officials, the public, around data that would like to be submitted for our for us to consider in the coordinated forecast. And then months three through six, we begin building the models, testing the models, running the models, and in month seven, we go back and hold a second meeting in a workforce area to release the preliminary forecast and seek additional input to ensure that we have public participation in this process and make sure that it's a transparent process. So that's done in month seven. And in month nine, we will issue a final forecast, which then begins the challenge period under which there's 45 days for individuals to officially challenge that population forecast by providing additional data. So again, the local and public input is an essential part of this project. The first meeting, as I mentioned to you, in addition to collecting that data, is explaining the methodology that we will be using for conducting these forecasts. And then the second meeting is, again, releasing those preliminary numbers, seeking input for the additional modifications or changes to the forecasts, and gathering additional data. And the last slide is just a sort of a snapshot of the deliverables. What will be the deliverables that we will be providing in this product? So, annual county level forecasts every year for a 50-year time horizon, and then city county coordinated forecasts for the next three to four years. And so the report will contain all information for cities and counties, population trends for cities and counties, as well as data gathered from the survey and data collected from the public, as well as assumptions about the future growth trends that are likely to occur in that county, as well as a short technical document which details the methods that we use to conduct the forecast. And I believe that's the last slide. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, Erin Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. I've provided some written testimony, and I won't read it because it's really long. But there's some few key concepts that are very important to the League of Cities about why this bill is so important. And the first is cost savings, and a timeliness issue. The foundation for every UGB expansion and some of our public works funding plans and infrastructure building comes from our population forecast. And for that reason, we need up-to-date, reliable information that won't be part of an ongoing challenge process. So when counties haven't provided cities with local numbers or recent numbers, cities will have to go out and get these numbers themselves under the current system, sometimes, in fact, contracting with Portland State to get that accomplished. So that's one cost that will be saved through this process. In addition, the cost of the appeal that is sometimes based on the population forecast individually once we've gotten through the process of a UGB expansion proposal will be taken off the table because there will have been that third-party, unbiased party doing these with the knowledge and expertise of, you know, PhDs. Secondly, and almost equally as important, is that there is local input into this process. The counties, the cities, the citizens will all have a voice in this process, talking with PSU, providing them with information and data. So maybe if the census says, you know, demographics trend this way, we can say, yes, but we've built a hospital in our city limits recently. We think that's going to drive employment and economic development, and therefore you should consider that in trending our forecasts and provide that kind of local information that they might not otherwise have, and being involved both of that during those two-month meetings, that 3 to 6 month period in which they're developing their forecasts, we're constantly involved in the process and allowed to put in our 2 cents worth of information, and then at the end with the preliminary reports and that review period, and then that final administrative review and 45 days before it's truly finalized, provides a lot of opportunities for local input that, you know, may change the forecast and make sure that we have all the information in the report, and then we understand all the information when we get the report out from PSU. And finally, just the consistency of having these reports done every 4 years for a city is very important because it allows the city to pick up the data when they need it and know that it is timely and accurate, which is it provides that adequate factual basis that's necessary under the goals for land use planning. And having them done consistently means that we know that they're up to date, which is vital for preventing us from making crazy UGB decisions or trying to fund infrastructure that we in fact don't need. And for those reasons, we support 2253, and I welcome any questions.
Okay, questions? Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair Clem.
Sorry.
That's okay. You didn't, and this is to whomever, I appreciate all the reasons why this might make sense. One of the things I'm concerned about is the accuracy of the reports. Right now, the way I understand the process works is that you get lots of different input from lots of different consultants, and while I can understand why that might be a little messy, it at least is information filled, and from that you can maybe get more accurate reports, maybe not. I'm curious to know, will this produce more accurate forecasts? And then I have a follow-up question after you ask that question.
Representative Unger, well, the answer to your question is the current situation is really one where the different methodologies really play out in terms of what the county can afford. So some counties with not a lot of resources are reliant on a ratio extrapolation. So taking a census number in 2000 and a number in 2010 and drawing a straight line and saying that's what is going to be future population, that is a generally accepted demographic method. The middle range methodology, which is a little bit more complex, the middle sort of model, is a cohort component model. And so what that simply means is we are taking into account births, deaths, migration, and immigration. We're taking into account the components of change. So generally, the cohort component model is a little bit more advanced and a little bit more accurate with respect to the fact that we're considering the population components of change. Then there's a third model, which is a little bit even more complex, which is a structural economic model. And that's the model that Metro uses for their population forecasting. And it's much more complex, much more advanced than we would need for purposes of the state's needs. Does that answer your question?
Follow up? Not really. So will it be more accurate?
Generally, yes, because the cohort component model is specifically addressing the components of change. So if we've looked at the cohort component model before, looking at the cohort component models of forecasts that we did in 1990, and we did a 20-year forecast of Oregon's counties through 2010, and so we wrote numbers and compared them to Census 2010's actual figures, and I can share those numbers with you if you'd like to see them.
I would, actually.
We were remarkably close in 31 of the 36 counties, less than 1%. So, yes, the direct answer to your question is we will have more accuracy with a cohort component model than we have with other more simplistic methods.
Thanks, sir. So my other questions are about the appeal process and the challenge process. Again, I understand the goal of efficiency. I think the appeal process and the challenge process is pretty important to the overall program as it currently exists. So can someone explain, I don't know who the right person is to explain that, maybe it's you, Aaron, how does the appeal process and challenge process work? And then my final question would be, what happens when we're wrong? Because unlike the current process, we don't have a way to appeal. But
Chair Clem, Representative Unger, I think that there are many opportunities for appeal and public input throughout this entire process. We are of the opinion that starting from a number that people can agree upon is sort of the foundation of the system, so that it doesn't get dragged down into interminable fights about whether my numbers are better than your numbers, and that we never move beyond that part of the discussion. So simply stated, if we can agree at least on one thing and then have that number updated every 4 years, we remove some of the aspirational aspects of it, and we reconfirm with a frequency that is usable to communities that they have a number that they can in fact use to make good planning decisions.
Follow up.
So, but then how does the appeal process work? I mean, how does the challenge process work? I mean, I appreciate that everyone agreeing would remove any kind of challenge process, but what I'm curious about is what happens. I mean, people never agree. This is land use planning. So what happens when they don't agree?
Chair Klein, Representative Unger, to answer your question, we have a process in place for challenging already around the population estimates program. That infrastructure is the infrastructure that we use for that challenge process is similar to what we've devised for this process, in the sense that by including as much public participation as possible, we have had one or two challenges in the past several years around the estimates program. And so there's a detailed approach around the data that will be the additional data that a individual can provide and a challenge within the challenge period for our consideration to modify that estimate, or in this case, the population forecast.
And Chair Clem, Representative Unger, I would also point out that there are periods within that planning process that not just call for public participation, but provide the actual the initial estimate or forecast. I'm sorry, technical terms. It provide that initial forecast, and that will allow both citizens and counties and cities that opportunity to get into it before there's even a final forecast. And then when that final forecast is issued, there's that 45 days in which cities, counties, citizens, anyone who wants to can review those numbers and get come back and say, this is the problem. You haven't taken into account X, Y, and Z, and that is turned back to PSU to then reconsider.
Is my question is how does that challenge process work? What considerations does PSU have to take into account? What if you'll get, I'm sure, 20 different people saying 20 different things about your forecast, and how do you come to a result that helps this process work better?
Chair Clem, Representative Unger. So the answer to answer your question, the challenge has to be based in with respect to the data inputs that we are using with respect to the forecast. So if there's a particular challenge about one of the assumptions that is embedded in the forecast, or there's a particular challenge around a data that hasn't been submitted, or there was a misinterpretation of the data, that is something that we will work through with respect to the challenging party. One of the concerns that was brought up with respect to this challenge period, 45 days, 60 days, is that the initial preliminary forecast will be issued in month 7. So that gives us 2 months of time to work with cities and counties across the state that may have additional issues with that preliminary forecast for us to make modifications to address their issues in that 2 month period. Then after that period, we issue the final forecast, then begins the clock for the next 45 days for them to initiate a challenge beyond that 60-day period that we had worked with them.
Okay. And then one last question.
New question, yeah. Representative Unger, go ahead.
On cost, let's change the subject again. I understand there's a request for $250,000, I think, to pay for this program to the state. It sounds like we're saving a bunch of money at the local level. Is there a match that's happening at the local level to match the investment from the state?
Chair Klein, Representative Unger, there is no match at the local level. What we are proposing is a $250,000 pop that would come from DLCD to the POP Center at Portland State. So that's $250 per biennium. In the last two biennia, we have used general fund grants to the tune of $90,000+ to support population estimates within the communities. We'll save that money. So that gets us to $350,000. The price tag is $425,000 per biennium. That leaves us $75,000 short. We will use a portion of our general fund grant program to cover those $75,000.
And if I guess follow up, would the cities be interested in a match? It seems like a good deal.
I don't think so.
Chair, so I'm Representative Ogre. No, thank you.
I am actually being kind of serious.
No, I understand. And where we are, where cities and counties are making the sacrifice is through that grant money, that we are no longer going to be eligible for those grants, because that grant money will go, instead of directly to the cities and counties doing the population forecasting, they will go to PSU instead. So we are not taking it out of our own bank account, but we're taking it out of from a sense of resources that we have already used for these particular projects. So we are giving part of our funding away.
Okay, thank you for indulging me.
That would be the ways and means issue for the co-chair of the committee who has this budget in his committee, trying to figure out how to balance a budget for some farm-to-school funding.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Okay. Any other questions for this panel, Representative Thatcher?
Thank you. You mentioned that you currently do some work for different agencies and all that, but is there any current, a statute already in place that requires PSU to do some work for a particular agency or to give some particular information to the state?
Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, can you clarify that?
Well, is PSU tasked through law to provide census information to any particular agency or the state for any particular, you know, point in time for anything.
So, Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, to answer your question, yes, through the two programs that I mentioned, okay. The Population Estimates Program, which is part in the ORS statutes, and the State Data Center. So we serve the entire state through the Oregon State Data Center, serving as a resource for all things census data.
And then follow up. Follow up to that. If this bill passed, no other entity could be utilized for population forecasting, correct? It would only be PSU.
Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, yes, that is my understanding.
So that's what raises a point. If we, you either can't change your name ever or we got to write the bill somehow to make it slightly flexible. If we name, you know, name an entity or its successor or something like that. Any other questions for these two? Representative Davis, yeah, we can't just
Thanks,
stop
Chair.
Now.
Man, it's only 4 o'clock, an hour left.
Yeah.
Let's do this.
There's two more bills.
Could you comment on the accuracy of the center's forecasts with respect to small cities and small counties in the state? That's the one concern I would have, and that some of my colleagues might have, I think, is in taking away the ability of smaller cities to hire their own consultants and take into account their own factors.
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, to answer your question, without having an exact forecast that you're referencing, I can tell you that we have done coordinated city-county forecasts for a number of counties across the state, and they have been repeat customers in the sense that we really pride ourselves on the accuracy of the forecast, the public public participation in terms of the forecast, and the transparency of the methodology. So, you know, Yamhill County, Marion County, Lane County, these are examples of counties that we've done the city coordinated county forecast for a number of different periods. So I would, you know, without speaking to a particular one, that would be my answer.
Thanks.
Okay. Okay, you're excused. And then we're coming back now to Richard and Carrie. So, for committee members' benefit, we're doing all the bill presentations before, but then we'll come back to the public on each of the bills. Well, it appears to be the same one member of the public only, so maybe Mary Kyle will just be by herself on three bills all at once. Or maybe there's some more sign-up sheets coming, I'm not sure, but okay. So now we're going to talk about 2254.
Yes. Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, if I may for just a moment, Carrie McLaren, Deputy Director from DLCD, I wanted to follow up on your question regarding the reliance or the single source, I would say, for obtaining population projections and make it clear that while these population projections are useful for a number of planning exercises, not just land use planning for cities and counties, the reliance or the limitation on it being a PSU-generated forecast would be for purposes of the urban growth boundary work that a city does only. So if, for example, for their schools or for their public facilities or for some other purposes they wanted to obtain a different forecasting methodology, there would be nothing that would foreclose them from doing so. We do believe, however, that this will provide a substantial resource that those communities don't have right now in making some of those planning decisions.
Please.
All right, Chair Clem, members of the committee, again for the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resource Advisor, and I'm going to talk to you about the other two bills in the package, House Bill 2254 and House Bill 2255. And 2254 is really the core bill in terms of a new method for cities to amend their urban growth boundary. A couple of introductory remarks on this. First of all, it is critical to understand that this is a new optional method. This is not a method that any city would be required to use. It is something that they could use if they elect to use. So we're going to leave the existing system in place. There are some circumstances where the existing system probably works better for cities. This new method will be used most of the time. That's the objective here, but we're not going to require any city to use it. The simple premise of this setup for House Bill 2254 and this new method is that if a city's population is growing, that you should be able to estimate what that city's land need is going to be based on its population growth. So could I see the next slide, please? What I'm going to do is go through each one of these elements of the steps that's set up by House Bill 2254. This is a general flowchart that shows how you get from a population forecast to an actual urban growth boundary decision. So next slide. So as you just heard, the first element of this is House Bill 2253, the population forecast. The first step in the urban growth boundary amendment process is to determine what the land need is for a city. And in this new method, the land need would be based on that population forecast. The population forecast would be converted into land need for residential use, for employment use, for other uses, including public facilities, based on that population forecast, and based on looking at other cities in the same area, same size range, and how much land they have used for a given amount of population growth. Next slide. So that exercise will give a gross land need number. The next question is, to what extent can that need for land be met by lands that are already within the urban growth boundary that are vacant, or lands that have been developed but that could be redeveloped? And then there's a third category, which is land that has been added to an urban growth boundary but has not got urban planning designations yet, and is still normally going to be outside of the city. So you need to look at the potential development capacity in those three subcategories of land, subtract that from the gross overall land need, and that gives you a net number, which is your land need for an urban growth boundary amendment. Next slide.
Chair Klein.
Representative Davis.
Yes.
Can you go back to the previous slide?
Yep.
And clarify the types of property that redevelopment might apply to?
Yes, Chair Klem, Representative Davis, the technical application of the term redevelopment would be to any land that is already developed, that already has development on it. So there is a gray area in a category of land where you've got some development but a large amount of vacant land also. That's called partially developed. But the redevelopment would apply to properties that have existing residential or commercial or industrial development on them. When you look empirically at cities and how much of new housing units have been provided through redevelopment, there's a range, and generally for large urban areas, that percentage can be fairly high. For smaller cities, rural areas, that percentage tends to be quite low. So part of what we would do here is look in that area of the state for cities, small cities, what has the experience generally been in terms of redevelopment?
Follow up. And I suppose the concern, going in the extreme example, is perhaps a rural city in which it has larger lots, let's say a 2-acre urban lot, and looking at that and saying we don't like the way that person is living on that urban lot. Maybe you could address that concern, because I'm sure that's been raised.
Absolutely. Chair Klem, Representative Davis, I actually really appreciate the question, because this is, it's really a key question in this whole system. Are we trying to create a quote, one-size-fits-all system where small cities have to look like Portland? Absolutely not. This has been very carefully designed, and let me explain how, so that we respect choices that individual cities want to make about how they want to grow and how they want to look in the future. And the way we do that is by looking empirically in different areas of the state for different classes of sizes of cities and identifying what a range is being that most cities fit within. So take off the extremes on either end, create a broad range, and say as long as a city is within that range going forward, you're good to go. You city can decide where in that range it lands. We're simply going to set the broad range based on empirical evidence. So it's designed to give both a lot of choice to local government while still having the system perform overall the way that it has been performing in terms of being efficient and protecting farm and forest land.
Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thanks. I'm curious how this plays into the lands that are in the buildable or defined as buildable land supply, and also how would you define lands that can't have the services supplied to them that they need to be developed? How do those get defined in this box?
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey. So two questions. First is on the buildable land piece. Let me answer that, and then I'll come back and talk about lands that are difficult or impractical to serve. On the buildable lands piece, we, in our existing system, have a requirement that cities inventory buildable lands, which you may be familiar with. That has been a source of some argument, and some of the legal cases in conflict we see is over judgments that cities make about what is or is not buildable. Part of this legislation, buried in the depths of it, is clarification, drawing some bright lines about what goes in that buildable land category and what does not, so that we don't have those squabbles going forward. So that's, I think, the answer on the buildable land piece. On the lands that are difficult to serve, this is actually a little bit later step in the process. I'll try to answer it now, but I'll also mention it when we get to it in the presentation. The concept here is you've identified an amount of land that you need. You're going to look around your existing boundary, and part of that analysis is going to be to identify lands that are impracticable to serve. And again, we're going to, based on empirical evidence of what has and what has not developed over time for an area of the state, we're going to draw some lines. And if an area meets certain criteria, you will be able to take it out of the calculus. You will not have to consider it for addition to your urban growth boundary. Okay. So, next slide. So that's pretty much where we are. The location is the next piece. You've got a quantity of land that you're looking to add to your urban growth boundary, and there will be, depending on the size of the city, that the larger the city, the further you'll have to look, but for a small city, quite close in. And then within that ring of which we call a study area, you will be able to exclude lands that are impracticable to serve. And again, that's going to be based on an empirical analysis that's done of actual development patterns in particular areas of the state. And, you know, if we have not seen lands develop over a period of time, we'll use that to set some criteria so that those lands can be excluded from the study area. Also, lands that fall into particular hazard categories will be excluded. These are lands that normally would not be considered part of the buildable land inventory, so lands within a 100-year floodplain, lands that have a slope over a certain degree. Those are probably lands that are in a tsunami inundation zone if you're on the coast. Those things would be excluded. And then lastly, The group also had a third basis for excluding lands, and that is if it's necessary to protect some unique natural resource. The example that was used in the group for that was actually the Columbia River Gorge. All right. So then what you're left with is a study area where you've excluded certain portions of that study area, and then you apply a hierarchy. This is similar to our existing system, but with a few differences. The first difference is, in terms of the first priority of lands to add to the urban growth boundary, we have collapsed three subcategories of types of land: urban reserves, which I'm going to talk about when I get to 2255, what are called exception lands, which are mainly going to be rural residential lands, and non-resource lands, which are rural lands that don't qualify as either agricultural or forest lands. From the state perspective, we don't care. That's should be a local decision which of those lands get brought in. If there is a large enough quantity of those lands in that first category to meet the need, that's the end of the exercise. You stop there. If there is not, you then go to the next step, which is lower value resource lands, and then the final step, high value resource lands. So similar to the existing system, this is another area where we have had substantial confusion and litigation created through some court cases and through the interaction between legislation and rules and goals of the Land Conservation and Development Commission. And so this new method straightens out that confusion and creates a clear pathway for cities. So key features of this system. The work group, in the work of the work group, involved a very delicate balancing exercise between different interests. We're working with, on the one hand, we need a system that truly works for cities and truly works for citizens and residents in cities so that they can understand the decisions that are being made. We also need a system that works for the development community. If it doesn't work for either of those interests, it's going to break down. But finally, we also want a system that continues to conserve and protect our important agricultural and resource lands. So there's a fine balance in this bill between those three interests. One of the key features of the bill is that it is intended to assure that we have an adequate supply of serviceable land for residential and employment uses, those two key uses where we do not want to see a shortage of land start to drive up land prices within cities. There are criteria within the decision-making process in the method so that cities have to assure that they actually have that supply of serviceable land. The second piece, which I haven't talked about yet and which some folks are going to come up and talk to you about in more detail in a minute, is urban services, clarity about who is going to provide urban services to the new urban areas. This has been another thorny issue. We are not talking about annexation here. We are talking about agreements between cities and districts over who is going to provide what services to particular areas. Cities, the larger cities using this new method, would go through a process where the cities, the city, and the districts would be required to work through and make and come to an agreement over who's going to be providing what services where. This is not for all of the urban services, it's for the key urban services: water, sewer, fire, and I'm leaving one out. Parks and Rec. Well, you will hear testimony on that in a minute. The key, though, is that we want to make sure that when cities and districts go through this process that we actually have clarity so the residents who are being affected by these decisions will know, as part of this process, who it is that's going to be providing their services long-term. The third key feature is It's designed to reduce cost in litigation. So this is designed so that a small city under a city of 2,500 with at best a part-time planner or a contract planner can get through this process in a reasonable amount of time with a high degree of certainty that they're not going to have to face litigation. The fourth piece is that this will replace something that has been an aspect of our land use system almost from the start called periodic review. Right now, only cities that have a population of 10,000 or more have to go through periodic review. It's a very expensive process. It's a very time-consuming process. It does have an important function, which is for the larger cities to update their planning to make sure that they have an adequate land supply and have updated their plans. But frankly, if cities are going through an urban growth boundary amendment process, they should be addressing those factors already. So this is a major benefit for cities of this new system. And then finally, last but not least, in terms of resource land protection, part of this system is putting in place the monitoring so that we can watch that trend, the rate of conversion of agricultural and forest land in different areas of the state to see whether it is accelerating or not accelerating, so that if things start to go in a direction that causes a concern, the system can be adjusted. So again, rather than getting into decision making for an individual city and telling an individual city what it should look like, this will monitor on a broader scale and look at how a whole area is doing in terms of outcome. So those are key features. The last thing I want to talk about is House Bill 2255, which is the employment land bill. It has two pieces. The first piece is industrial reserves, and the second is large industrial opportunities. This legislation really tears off some legislation that was enacted in 2011, Senate Bill 766, which set up a expedited permitting process for industrial projects of state significance, and also set up areas where permitting could be expedited that are regionally significant for industrial uses. The first piece of this, industrial reserves, would allow a city to identify for a longer term where they are likely to grow for traded sector industrial purposes. It would give the cities some more flexibility in terms of where those are located, but in return would require that the lands actually be used for industrial use, not planned for industrial use and then converted to some other use, but actually used for employment purposes. The second piece relates to situations which we see from time to time where we have as a state or as a region or a community an opportunity with a very large industrial employer, and there is not a site for that employer, not a site within the existing urban growth boundary, not even a site on rural lands that's planned for industrial use. This would allow permitting of a site for a large industrial user outside the urban growth boundary if, and there are a set of conditions. The first condition is the city and the county both have to agree that they want to do this. So this only happens if the city and county want to do it. Second, there has to be a commitment, a binding commitment from the prospective employer to provide at least 500 jobs. Third, there has to be a documented need from the employer for at least 150 acres of land. Fourth, there has to be a showing that that site is not available within the existing urban growth boundary and, in fact, is not available on rural lands that are already planned for industrial uses in the vicinity. So if those conditions can be met, we truly have a situation where we have a great opportunity for an employment gain and there is not a site that we can take advantage of it. The site also has to be adjacent to an existing urban growth boundary. It can't be out in the middle of nowhere. So it has to be, and the reason for that is so that it makes sense long term. It can become part of the urban area over the long term. So those are the two pieces of the employment bill. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions. Again, we are working with Legislative Council on amendments to these. On House Bill 2255, we're going to have one more meeting of our small team to talk about a few issues. But we should be back before you with Legislative Council amendments for the committee to consider, I hope, in the very near future. Thank you.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard, thank you for a great, simple presentation. Wish the land use process was that simple. On the large industrial opportunity, you just mentioned has to be adjacent to the urban growth boundary.
Correct.
And you're saying physically right there up against it.
It has to.
Half a mile away, wouldn't work.
Chair Clem, Representative Cameron, that's correct. It would have to touch the existing urban growth boundary.
Just to follow up, is there a reason for no flexibility there?
Chair Clem, Representative Cameron, I think the policy concern is what I mentioned. If you don't require adjacency, then you have the potential for a use to pop up basically in the middle of a rural area without a connection to an urban area. So in terms of getting services to it, in terms of traffic back and forth, that causes some concerns. I'll never say never, Representative, but that's the policy basis.
And the other real way to do it out in the middle of nowhere, literally, is just by exception, and you're not gonna seize an opportunity using that on any short-term basis anyway.
Chair Clem, if I could, this design is very much set up to essentially provide an expedited way of getting an exception. You can think of it that way, and with more certainty in terms of the process also. That's basically how it's designed.
So even if the cities and the counties agreed to bring the services and the infrastructure to that half mile or mile, is there in this the ability to make that exception?
Chair Clem, Representative Cameron, not as the bill is currently drafted. This would be something that we may have some discussion about in the smaller group.
Would be good. Thank you.
Representative Davis.
Thank you.
2 points. A comment on Vice Chair Cameron's. I think the policy consideration is a good one. I think the implementation in the current form of the bill is a bit rigid, requiring physical adjacency. And some flexibility could be added in without departing at all, actually, from the policy consideration. I realize once we're getting out to 5, 10, 15 miles. But it seems like there's got to be a middle way. That's a comment. My question is with regard to the 500 jobs. And there have been discussions among colleagues of mine that bars get set too high for rural communities. Do we have a history of developments like this outside the metro area that include 500 jobs? That's a lot of jobs.
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, I would have to do a little bit of research to get back to you on that. My belief is that there are at least a few employers in Southern Oregon and in Eugene Springfield area that might, and probably Salem, that might tip that, but it's not going to be many areas of the state.
Yeah.
And we were chatting about something that I think I got right. On the little slide that described the two, the kind of 766 slide along with whatever the other number that you have on there is, the top
1, which talks about creating regionally significant industrial areas or industrial projects of state significance. Those could be in rural areas or other areas, but they don't have the sideboards you just mentioned. It's a different expedited process. And we have one that's been designated in the interim here since we passed that bill that maybe it'd be helpful for people to hear about. But I don't know how to say it. It's either Goshen or Goshen.
Goshen.
Is that one of yours?
Maybe. No.
He has like 80 cities. I can never. Oh, my heart. Almador.
Chair Clem.
Why do I know the name? It's pretty damn close.
Yeah. Chair Clem, and thank you, Representative Holdy. So we have been working with local governments in the Eugene-Springfield area on a proposed potential regionally significant industrial area in the Goshen community south of Eugene and Springfield. I don't believe it's designated yet, but it's being looked at very seriously.
But something like that doesn't have the sideboards that you just mentioned in this target large industrial opportunities part.
Chair Clem, that's correct. The criteria for designation are different. It can be used in the Goshen area, would be used and applied to a rural industrial area.
There's no job limitations, blah, 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 blah.
Chair Clem, that's correct. The second bullet there under Senate Bill 766, the industrial projects of state significance does have some criteria related to jobs, but not the regionally significant industrial areas.
Representative Davis.
Thank you for the presentation. It's very good. Getting to the point about the reduction in litigation, could you cover again, maybe you did and I just missed it, ways in which this process would do that?
Chair
He's
Clem.
A lawyer. He may not be in favor of that.
And could we amend it to increase litigation? Because I'm looking out for my colleagues.
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, if you've ever done land use litigation, it's not something, even if you're a lawyer, you necessarily want to get into.
No, it's not.
Some say that it's even worse than tax law.
Yes, it is.
So how does this reduce litigation? It does it in several different ways. First of all, it makes some of the decisions more objective in the process. Number two, I alluded to ranges. Some of the criteria that are set are not single point criteria, they are ranges. And the bill is drafted so that if a local government makes a decision within that range, it is not required to adopt findings explaining why it chose a particular point within that range. That's the sort of thing that we see repeated litigation over. The bill is express that no findings are required so long as you're within the range. And then finally, and very important, right now, judicial review of the larger urban growth boundary decisions, which are made by the Land Conservation and Development Commission, go to Land Development and Conservation Commission and then go to the Court of Appeals. They're not expedited. They can take a long time. The City of Woodburn's a great example of a situation that's taken a long time to resolve. This bill would have review of a local urban growth boundary amendment go to the Land Use Board of Appeals rather than LCDC.
Okay.
It's an expedited process, less expensive, and importantly, the review of LUBA's decision goes to the Court of Appeals and it's expedited at the Court of Appeals.
Okay. Interesting.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've talked about ranges. Could you give an example of what you mean by ranges? Like, are you talking about density or perhaps lot sizes, like was talked about earlier? What?
Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, so let me give you a couple of examples. The step here is the conversion of that population forecast into a land need. So several... That will be done by category of a broad category of use. So, for instance, One category would probably be public facilities, so schools, fire, religious institutions, streets. There would be an empirical look at small cities, let's say within the Willamette Valley, and how much land has been needed for those uses based on a particular increment of population growth. And we would see what the range has been, and we would take the middle 75-80% of that range, and we would say to the small city, as long as you're within that range in coming up with your land need estimate, you're good. We would do the same thing with regard to housing, and we would do the same thing with regard to employment uses.
Okay,
follow up.
Because I'm really unfamiliar how UGBs are actually developed. So a city comes to you and says, well, we need X number of acres for, like what you said, X number of acres for residential, X number of acres for this, and that's kind of how, you know, loosely what composes their land need?
Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, yes. So that's more or less the way that it is done now, but the process for getting to that number is very complicated, much more complicated than what I just described. Under the existing system.
Sorry. Representative Holden?
I'm just going to go back a step. I'm sure this will come out later on, but previously you had talked about the urban services agreements that will happen to enable the development, and this is sort of outside of the annexation questions. I'm going back several slides. Is this sort of a step away from the annexation process in terms of getting developable land inside the urban growth boundaries?
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, no, it's not a step away from the existing annexation system. What it is doing is assuring that if land is going to be brought within an urban growth boundary, there is some way of providing services to it. It's agnostic. It doesn't care whether it's a district or a city that does that. That's left up to the normal annexation process.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
And so in developing, I guess, that pathway, is one of the criteria going to be the equitable distribution for taxation, I guess, for payment of those services throughout the urban growth area?
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, there are factors that are built into that. Speaking very generally, but I would suggest posing the question to representatives for the districts or the cities, there is in the factor a consideration of the essentially the fiscal impact on districts.
And Chair Clem, members of the committee, just for clarification, the types of districts, and again, the representative from the Special Districts Association can speak to this, but concerns domestic water, sanitary districts, fire districts, and parks and recreation districts.
Thank you.
Just one quick comment,
yeah.
If I can.
Representative Unger.
Just a comment, which one of the things I like about this proposal is the rigidity, so keeping it close to the urban growth boundary and touching it is, in my opinion, a good idea. Just in case you were wondering about the temperature of this half of the dais.
I'm at 1,000 feet.
Always moderate.
Okay. I think we've exhausted ourselves for you all. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mary Kyle, do you want to come up? And Mark Landauer. Now, Mr. Chandler, I'd like to note that just because you're not going to testify apparently this whole session doesn't mean there isn't a land use committee. Oh, good. Okay. You can will us out of existence if you want, but we're still here. So why don't, do you want to talk about them together? That'd probably help us, or do you
I mean, I don't have to make you come up, go back, come up again on two different bills. Can you just cover both bills together, or all three bills together? I've got you on three sign-up sheets, I think.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, Mary Kyle McCurdy representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Yes, I would prefer to do that. I was going to ask if I could, in particular because our comments are going to be fairly general at this point since you don't have bill language in front of you. Perhaps you have 2253. I'm not sure about that, but the other bills. Okay. So I was just going to speak generally, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Again, Mary Kyle McCurdy with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Members of our staff, including myself and other staff members, have been involved with the committees that Richard described that developed the three bills that are before you today. And I'm going to just touch briefly on them, and I anticipate we'll have more detailed comments when we have actual language. House Bill 2253, the population projection one, we support that bill. Population projection element of evaluating whether or not a city needs an urban growth boundary expansion or any other land use and transportation related changes is the most data-driven technical aspect of the land use planning process, and we think it's appropriate that it stays or goes to with an entity like Portland State that has expertise in conducting this very technical, as I said, data-driven population projections. What one does with those population projections in terms of how to accommodate growth and employment, that is appropriate for the political leaders and the community, but we think that population projection is not a time that we should be spending a lot of time and money. So, excuse me, and it was already mentioned, it hasn't really been happening now in many of those small cities, small counties, and even large cities and large counties around the state. We don't have coordinated population projections, and that's been very frustrating and expensive, especially for cities that are growing and want to look at UGB expansions. They've had to spend a lot of their own money to get those population projections done and coordinated. Turning to House Bill 2254, the UGB bill, I think it's, again, appropriate to remind the committee that it is an optional process to go through. Thank you. This has just happened in the last day. Thanks, Richard. Thank you, Representative Holdy. We believe that House Bill 2254 will provide a streamlined UGB evaluation process without getting away from the substantive policy objectives that we have through having urban growth boundaries. However, the other current way of conducting the UGB evaluation and expansion will be available to cities if they want to use that method. We have agreed with the language that was submitted to Legislative Council to draft into this bill, so we anticipate that we will continue to be able to support the bill when it comes before you, but obviously we haven't seen that legislative language yet, so there may be changes that we will be recommending, but we have agreed to the language that went into Legislative Council. What we particularly like about this bill is that, since the time that urban growth boundaries were first delineated in the late 70s and early 80s, the first round of urban growth boundaries, one of the reasons it's become more complex is because we are a lot better at generating data. That data is very accessible to the public. The public is very engaged in the growth of their communities, and it's, for many good reasons, become a longer and more complex process, but we've also learned from that that there is a standard range, as Richard was describing, of ways in which one can estimate the land need or other capacity need of an urban growth boundary based on that same experience. Richard used the example of the percentage of urban land that is required to provide infrastructure. There's a range that's pretty standard amongst small cities and large cities, and we don't need to spend a lot of time and money developing that information or arguing about it. Also, the issue that I think Representative Davis raised about redevelopment. Currently, cities generally use a formula for whether or not any particular land inside their urban growth boundary is redevelopable based on the value of the structure on it versus the value of the land underneath it and whether that is likely to redevelop over a 20-year time period. That can be a pretty time-intensive process to do for given cities, but we've now come to see that there's a generally observed rate of redevelopment in cities with certain growth rates of certain sizes in certain parts of the state that we can use as a more standardized range. And again, cities can use the existing way if they believe there's something unique to their city. And finally, the 2254, the emphasis is really on not only serviceable land, but actually serving that land. In my experience over many years of dealing with urban growth boundary evaluations, the notion of whether or not we communities and the state can really afford to service that land eventually is not really front and center in a lot of these discussions or in the law. And that will be a more prominent part of this streamlined urban growth boundary process, to actually focus on servicing the land and not always talking about new land at the edge, but servicing the land that we already have. And finally, turning to House Bill 2255, the one on industrial reserves and large industrial opportunities, we don't have a position on that bill at this time. As Richard mentioned, the committee, the small group that's been working on this, is still meeting, so we don't have language that I can tell you that we've all agreed to or that's gone into legislative council. Thank you.
Mr. Landauer.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I'm going to speak to House Bill 2254 and confine my comments primarily to the Urban Services Agreements component of this package. House Bill 2254, as Mr. Whitman had previously mentioned, will effectively eliminate periodic review under this expedited process. As a component of periodic review since 1993 under Senate Bill 122, urban services agreements, local governments and special districts that provide urban services, and those urban services are fire, water, sewer, Parks Rec, transit, and transportation within an area of an urban growth boundary that has a population in excess of 2,500 shall enter into urban services agreements as a component of the periodic review process. Of course, because the periodic review process under 2254 is effectively going to be eliminated under this new process, special districts, needless to say, were and have been a bit concerned. Over the years, of course, the population threshold for conducting periodic review has also increased over time from that 2,500 number up to the present number of 10,000. And oftentimes, as a result of not only the byproduct of those population thresholds increasing, urban services agreements, by and large, across the state, have not been undertaken by cities and districts. And these agreements are very important for a number of reasons, and I'll just mention a couple. They help avoid duplication of infrastructure investments. They help urban service providers plan for infrastructure needs in the future. They're beneficial to both the citizens and businesses because they will know who will be their providers in the future. The bottom line is these agreements provide clarity on who will, when, and where those services will be provided. During the discussions leading up to the proposal that's before you, we, of course, expressed some concerns that as a result of this new process that would effectively eliminate periodic review, that in fact it would create a vacuum that urban services would no longer be required. And through a great deal of work, Mr. Whitman effectively sent the League of Oregon Cities and the special districts off to a corner and go figure it out. I'm actually here, and this may be a rare moment where the cities and the special districts have come to an agreement on how urban services agreements will be put into this process. And the bottom line is the districts and the cities will be entering a mediation process. If that doesn't effectuate an urban services agreement, will effectively go into binding arbitration. The key component to this whole thing, though, will be that under current statute, when a city annexes territory of a special district under ORS 222-510, they can effectively withdraw that territory from a district. Under this new process, a city would still be able to annex into a territory of a special district that's providing an urban service. However, they would not be able to withdraw that territory unless and until an urban services agreement had been completed and agreed upon. And we'll talk more about this. I will note, though, that this agreement only applies to this expedited process. We, from the special districts, remain concerned that there are a good number of areas that still lack these urban services, and I hope to be able to appear before you again at some point during this session to talk to you about potential solutions for that. Thank you.
Questions for these two? Representative Holloway.
I'm just curious if you can speak to the duration of urban service agreements.
I can, and I'm familiar with a few, Chair Clem, Representative Holby. Oftentimes, these agreements will have a period of time, say 5, 10, maybe even 20 years. However, oftentimes in these agreements, there are opportunities for one side or the other to opt out with a prior notification to the other party. But that's generally how they operate. Certainly under this process, there will be any time a city wants to enter an expedited process, the city will be required, for example, to notify any affected urban service special districts, at which time a clock will begin for which an urban service agreement will need to be negotiated if that is the desire of the special district. One option, of course, could be that a special district may not want to enter into that process or have an urban services agreement, and that would effectively be the urban services agreement. We agree not to have an urban services agreement, and a city would be available to withdraw territory upon annexation at that point.
You're waiting for another question.
I'm hoping there isn't one.
Me too.
Oh. There is, but I'm not going to ask.
Okay, thank you. You're excused.
Thank you.
Mr. Chandler, and then Representative Gilliam, do you want to come up and comment on periodic review vis-a-vis this USA, you know, UGB sort of issue?
I do, but I've got a tanning bed appointment.
I almost made a tanning joke, but you did it for yourself. It's fantastic.
Me too.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Me too.
I got an appointment as well. That my state rep just took a dive on the issue facing the committee.
Yeah, you're Bob's the
just
plan.
Saying.
Come on,
I'm just
get
saying.
Up here.
John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I did have a 45-minute PowerPoint ready to go, but in light of the time, I'll try to shorten her down to about 30 minutes. I just want to put a few thoughts on the record pending future discussion of these bills. We are very supportive of the direction these are going. We continue to have some concern, particularly about 2254, and we'll be working with Mr. Whitman and the rest of the group to try to iron those things out. The population forecasting bill, I think, is absolutely on the right track. The last language we saw, we were in 100% agreement with it. The industrial lands bill is still being worked on, I think is going the right direction as well. If not, there's some interesting looking vehicles on the Senate side that very well may land in your committee, Mr. Chair, if that one doesn't go. With regard to 2254, just some very broad ideas I wanted to plant with the committee. from the developer standpoint, we obviously are very interested in having urban growth boundaries work, both the expansion of them and the development inside of them. And we think that the changes that Mr. Whitman described to the committee, both this meeting and the one prior, are critically important. This is a good program we've had. We've been sort of the loyal opposition over the years. I often say that we started going to the land use church not right through when the first hymn was sung, but just in time for the collection plate to be passed. And we try to be supportive of the program and be honest in our criticism of them when need be. With regard to 2254, one of the things in the bill is trying to say that, as Mr. Whitman told you, we've done a really good job in Oregon. I think it's very important to claim that success and not come before you or any other body and say, well, we've done a poor job over the years. We've done an excellent job over the years. I think something in the law that says cities can't go backwards is appropriate. I'm not sure, and I think we've been very cautious and hope we'll continue to watch the language to make sure that we're not requiring constant improvement, either of density or efficiency or what you want to call it. There's going to be a point at which communities have to be left to choose their own path, obviously balancing that against the need for resource protection. The issue of serviceability has come up many times, both with regard to the Urban Services Bill, which we're also in support of or hope to be in support of. That's critical that we have serviceable land. That's one of the pieces of this process that's in front of you that we're very supportive of, not just a land supply issue, but a land supply that can be actually built upon within a reasonable period of time. That's been one of the problems of our land use system historically, is we've had a bunch of fistfights and arguments and litigation and entertainment for lawyers on the out years, years 15 to 20. We really haven't focused on year 0 to 5 or 0 to 7 in this bill. So I think that's important. How that gets defined, though, and how it works itself out on the ground is going to be even more critical than having the requirement in the first place. And on the issue of serviceability more broadly, as Mr. Whitman said, having services is critical. But I just want to state for the record, we couldn't care less. We love the cities, we love the counties, we love the districts. We don't care who gets us water, sewer, and roads. We're not only agnostic, we're right close to atheism on that. It's just simply not an issue. We want to make sure we have it. We hope that our friends in local government can work out those agreements through urban services agreements. If not, we still need that service provided to us in order for the serviceability piece of this legislation and for the land use system to function properly. As one of my members said, and I think this is an important concept, if the development community, be it residential, commercial, industrial, is being asked to build better and more efficiently and inside the boundary at the densities and levels that are being expected, then we have to have the tools to do that. We have to have the infrastructure in the ground. We have to have the local zoning in place. We have to have a bunch of other moving parts there, and oftentimes we feel like those aren't there. We think this legislation, the concepts at least, move us in the right direction. Final thing I'll say, Mr. Chair and members, is that there's been a little bit of discussion today, and there'll be more in the future, I'm sure, about rigidity of planning versus aspiration of planning. And I will just simply point out as an editorial comment that the Oregon land use system has never had a problem with aspiration when it came to density or transit or inside the boundary efficiencies and such as that. The only place we've had a difficulty with aspiration is when it came to movement of boundaries or development issues. I don't have any problem with saying no aspirations. I have no problem with saying everybody gets to aspire, but I do have a problem that historically the thumb has been on the scale one direction, and I think these bills are going the right direction to try to even that out, but I think that's important that one person's aspiration is another person's excellent plan. And I think we need to have a system that recognizes, gives local governments and local communities the ability to choose their path within the confines of the law, again, without respecting the need to protect natural resources and be good stewards of what we've been given in this state, but to not try to shoehorn people into a particular predetermined good development pattern. Look forward to working on this bill and seeing this committee. And Mr. Chair, contrary to your assertion earlier, I think this is a grand committee, and I'm looking forward to many happy hours in front of you, he said insincerely.
I think Representative Gilliam came here just to supervise your testimony. I have no other.
My state rep.
Yeah, that's right.
That explains it.
Explains one or the other up in Hawaii, that's for sure. I'm not sure which
yeah,
way it goes.
That's right. Any other questions? Well, not other. Any questions for Mr. Chandler? Thing. It's 2 minutes before 5 o'clock.
Excellent.
That probably explains our
work
silence.
Is done. Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearings on House Bills 2254 and 2255. I'm quite certain I don't need to carry it over.
No, you do not. No, you don't. We're going to skip the next time.
And adjourn the committee.
Yes.